Hello, I'm Lisa Mann. This is number 0431, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0431. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Jeremy Dauber, who is the author of Jewish Comedy, A Serious History.
Some of this was autobiographical. You know, I really grew up saturated in my house with Jewish comedy. We watched it in sort of the movies of Mel Brooks and Woody Allen, and we read it in, you know, stories by people like Philip Roth or Shalom Aleichem. There would be Jewish jokes around the house and things like that. But it was really only when I got to college and then graduate school and then started teaching that I said, you know what, this really could be a scholarly subject of study. You can tell a lot about a people by what makes them laugh and how they choose to make those laughs.
Kevin Cochran Jr. is the author of Where the Magic Happens, the science and stories behind challenging your comfort zone.
The problem is that a lot of us get caught up in day-to-day routines and deadlines and assignments and all these different things that kind of hold us back from that magical existence that we can have. So when I'm talking about where the magic happens, I'm talking about getting to that point where you're living your life in a way that makes you happy, makes you comfortable. It's kind of counterintuitive because through the process of being uncomfortable several times, you actually can become more comfortable in many situations.
Dr. Camille Superson is the author of Essential Resource Guide for Caregivers. Save time, save money, save your sanity.
Most of the resources that are in the book will save thousands of dollars every single year. And most importantly, many of the resources in the book are free. And that was the astounding part that I discovered through the 10 years of caregiving. So knowing that I was not alone in this situation, that there were other people just like me going through this every single day, costing them their lives often, because one-third of all caregivers die before the people that they're taking care of, which is an unbelievable statistic.
And there's lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0431 was Lisa Mann, who is an actress, singer, broadcaster, and all-around nice person who lives in Kingston, Ontario. Thank you very much, Lisa, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, if any of you are on social media, you've probably seen the pictures depicting this story. It's also been all over the news. Officials with the Naval Air Station Whidbey Island said one of their aircraft was involved in the obscene skywriting spotted in Okanagan County, Washington. Photos by multiple sources show sky drawings of what people say are male genitalia. A mother who lives in Okanagan said she was upset she might have to explain to her young children what the drawings were. You know, if your children are so young that they wouldn't know what that was, then they're young enough for you to say that they were just clouds. Anyway, Navy officials said the Navy holds its aircrew to the highest standards, and we find this absolutely unacceptable, of zero training value, and we're holding the crew accountable. FAA officials said unless the act poses a safety risk, there is nothing they can do about it. The officials said they cannot police morality. But, you know, you have to admit, if you've seen the pictures, and by now I'm sure you may have, that's some pretty impressive flying. It can't be easy to use an airplane to draw mile-wide testicles in the sky like that. I'm just saying. Anyway, New Zealand police pulled over a man because he was driving while playing the bagpipes. Yeah, you heard me right. The driver didn't have their hands on the wheel at the time, and he was clearly playing the instrument while driving the car, said Acting Sergeant Bryce Johnson. His fingers were going a million miles an hour, Johnson added. However, the driver denied the allegations and said he was only playing the air bagpipes. There's something like the air bagpipes, really? But Johnson said that he was certain he saw a block-type instrument that looked like a clarinet. The driver was let off without a warning. Johnson said police were on the lookout for people driving while using their mobile phones. We are also concerned with the amount of drivers using mobile phones while driving, he said. Neither of these things are a good idea. Wow. Playing the bagpipes in a moving car. He must have sounded like a European ambulance going by. Yeah. A Florida man is fighting his condo association for the right to keep his pet, a squirrel he registered as an emotional support animal. Ryan Boylan, who lives at Island Walk Condominiums in Clearwater Beach, said he rescued Brutus, the squirrel, last year in the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. Ever since then, I mean, oh my God, I can't imagine not being around her, Boylan said. Why would you name a female squirrel Brutus? Anyway, Brutus came to property management's attention when she was chased up a tree on the property by a dog. Boylan's condo association sent him a notice last month telling him to get rid of the squirrel or find a new place to live. Boylan registered Brutus as an emotional support animal at the website registermyserviceanimal.com after obtaining a note from his doctor in July. The doctor's note said Boylan suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder stemming from a car accident. The Office of Human Rights, which was contacted by Boylan, sent a letter to the association stating that emotional support animals are protected under the Fair Housing Act. An emotional support squirrel. Can the emotional support pigeon be far behind? And speaking of which, a woman was kicked off an airplane when her hog began causing problems in the aisles. And no, that's not a euphemism. One shocked onlooker said the brown swine looked about to be 70 pounds as it was tossed over the unidentified woman's shoulder and marched off. Others initially thought it was a duffel bag, but were given the shock of their lives when it began oinking on board the U.S. Airways flight out of Connecticut. One passenger said she tethered it to the armrest next to me and started to deal with her stuff. But the pig was walking back and forth. I was terrified because I was thinking, I'm going to be on a plane with a pig. American Airlines, the parent company to U.S. Airways, confirmed it was taken on board as an emotional support animal. Really? I'll put up with an emotional support pork on a commercial flight when pigs fly. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, never mind. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Jews have, for over the last century, been known for humor. The story of Jewish comedy is vast, and if it resolutely resists any single explanatory lens, it is also surely a tradition. Jeffrey Dauber knows about Jewish comedy from a historic perspective. He's a professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Columbia University, and is the author of Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. Jeremy joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Since you are a professor of Yiddish language, the first thing I've got to ask is, do you find that what we now know as Jewish comedy, Jewish humor, what we hear stand up from the Catskills to beyond, is it something that is originally translated from Hebrew or Yiddish? Or are they two different animals?
I think it's a great question, because the answer is sort of yes and. On the one hand, a lot of this comedy that comes out, the comedy that we think of as modern Jewish comedy, the Catskills, the Borscht Belt, all of that is really created by people who are largely speaking native English speakers in a very American or North American context, as a result of really living in an American condition. On the other hand, one of the things that I argue in my book is that sometimes knowingly, sometimes not, it's the latest strand or in a long tradition of Jewish comedy, which has a great deal of the Hebrew and Yiddish in it. So it's sort of both.
What made you decide to write this book? I know it's something that you study literature and you teach literature and culture, but specifically on comedy, and the subtitle, A Serious History.
Well, first I should say that some of this was autobiographical. You know, I really grew up saturated in my house with Jewish comedy. We watched it in sort of the movies of Mel Brooks and Woody Allen, and we read it in, you know, stories by people like Philip Roth or Shalom Aleichem. There would be Jewish jokes around the house and things like that. But it was really only when I got to college and then graduate school and then started teaching that I said, you know what, this really could be a scholarly subject of study, but also it could be something that could be a key to a lot of the other things that I'm thinking about in my career about how Jewish literature, history, culture, civilization work. You know, you can tell a lot about a people by what makes them laugh and how they choose to make those laughs. And that was something that was worth studying. And then a lot of people were interested, so I thought about writing kind of a user-friendly book about it.
Since you were so immersed with it, as you say, from your childhood, and what was it like for you to realize that once you got out into the mainstream world, that the Jewish comedy had permeated the mainstream world?
Well, you know, I think that on the one hand, it wasn't such a surprise because I knew that, you know, the movies that I was watching, you know, were movies that lots of people had seen. The books were books that lots of people were reading. What I'm not sure that I realized quite as profoundly was how differently the ways in which other people necessarily were seeing these particular works. So, for example, you know, there's a scene in Blazing Saddles where the Native Americans, Mel Brooks has them speaking Yiddish. And, you know, as I was growing up, we kind of all knew that they were speaking Yiddish. And, of course, I realized later on that not everybody understood that this was going on, that this is what they were doing. And it ended up being a kind of very instructive example. The same thing with Seinfeld, where, you know, for us, my family, my friends, this was really classic kind of Jewish comedy. For other people, this was just a bunch of crazy people in New York City.
So just based on that, and again, we are talking about Jewish comedy, I guess we should start from the beginning, and that is, what would you call or what would you define Jewish comedy to be?
You know, it's a good question, and it's one that really I had to take on right at the beginning, right up front of the book. And just to kind of put some boundary on all of the massive amount of material over the centuries and over the continents, I sort of said, look, you know, Jewish comedy has to be produced by someone who, by whatever definition, considers themselves to be Jewish. And secondly, it has to have something to do with Jewish history, culture, or experience. Those were basically, so, you know, if Ben Schwartz had written a really killer knock-knock joke, you know, unless that had something to do with the Jewish experience, that was going to be out. But basically anything else could theoretically be in. And that, of course, still left quite a lot of material to kind of work through.
Some people obviously see comedy as a sort of release valve for life. And let's be honest, there is a certain sense of persecution within the Jewish community that is certainly there. Is comedy a release for that? Is that part of where the comedy comes from?
I think that the key part of your question is that word part. You know, one of the things I really wanted to make sure that I addressed in the book was that Jewish comedy is all sorts of things. It's not just one thing. So certainly a very significant strand of Jewish comedy over the years has been a kind of psychic resistance, resilience, relief, and a response to persecution, as a response to anti-Semitism. But there's a lot of Jewish comedy that has to do with sort of witty, elusive byplay in literature based on sort of Jewish texts or a kind of internal religious thinking about sort of comparing God's promise to sort of the situation in the world or many, many other kinds of things. So, you know, Jewish comedy is broad and wide and deep, and I tried to trace as many of the channels as I could.
A lot of early Jewish comedy also deals with European or Eastern European backgrounds and the people that come from them. I'm just curious to know, as Jewish humor evolves over the years, the fact that we have second, third generation Jews living in the United States, if that itself changes Jewish humor?
You know, I think it absolutely does. I mean, you know, all great humor, I think, whether Jewish or not, you know, has to do with the juxtaposition of, you know, personal idiosyncratic voice and circumstance and the kind of larger universal human condition, right? Some juxtaposition between those two things. And so as the circumstances of Jews in a comparatively speaking over Jewish history, very welcoming North America has happened, you know, Jews are trying to grapple with sort of the prospect of acceptance and success. And so that has created a very different kind of comedy on one hand for some of these comedians. On the other hand, you know, there is this sense, I think, that is almost central to a lot of this Jewish comedy of there's still something different. There's still something that's setting us apart. There's still something that's putting us off to the side. And what exactly is this if it's not necessarily our religious observance or if it's not necessarily our, you know, an active part of our identity and belief or something like that? What is it? And that, I think, is a lot of the most interesting comedy is trying to figure out now what that Jewishness is.
Humor or comedy in general, regardless of the ethnic or religious background, is it not usually always from the perspective of an observer on the outside looking in?
I think it is. I think, you know, and what exactly that outsiderness consists of, you know, very much depends from comedian to comedian. It may be because they're Jewish, it may be because they're a woman, it may be because they're a Jewish woman, it may be, you know, all sorts of kinds of possibilities. But and sometimes it's just a matter of saying, look, I just look at the world very differently than everyone else around me. And if I frame that in exactly the right way and pitch it back to quote-unquote the normals, they're going to laugh because they recognize themselves in this kind of cracked mirror. And, you know, Jewish comedy is that, but Jewish.
The title is simply Jewish comedy. I'm assuming that you're looking at an audience much more broad than just Jews. This book is something...
I certainly hope so, yeah.
This book is something that would appeal to everyone. Are you looking at it as an, especially considering you're a teacher, are you looking at it from an educational point of view or just, you know, just a curiosity point of view?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've found over the course of teaching about this, both in and out of the classroom for now almost 20 years, is that people, both Jews and non-Jews, like you say, people really are interested in this. They find particular comedians that they love. They find particular kinds of jokes or humor that they've always been interested in, and they just want to learn more about it. And so I thought, let's write a book in a kind of entertaining, accessible, but serious way, you know, that gives people, that satisfies the curiosity, the intellectual curiosity they have, but at the same point, you know, is a fun read, and I hope that's what I've accomplished here.
It's a fantastic topic. It's also one that interests a lot of people, and it's a great book. The book is Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. Jeremy, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Jeremy Dauber, author of Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0431, and you'll find links to Jeremy's site and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Where the Magic Happens, the science and stories behind challenging your comfort zone. Plus, we'll give some tips to people who are caregivers out there. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on a program that is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to make this radio show an even bigger and better radio experience. And let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? A couple who say they were handcuffed for hours in a police patrol car after their hibiscus plants were confused for marijuana are suing the police and an insurance company. Edward and Audrey Kramer say in a lawsuit filed Tuesday that a nationwide insurance company agent investigating a fallen tree at their Buffalo Township home sent photos of their flowering plant to police. The lawsuit alleges that Buffalo Township police officers with assault rifles went to their home on October 7th to investigate. Audrey Kramer, who is 66 years old, said she was partially dressed when she went to the door and police would not let her put pants on before she was handcuffed. "I was not treated as though I was a human being," she said. "I was just something they were going to push aside." 69-year-old Edward Kramer said he returned home a half hour later to find his wife in the back of a police cruiser and officers pointing guns at him. He also was placed in the cruiser despite trying to convince the officers the plants were hibiscus, not marijuana. "They actually ignored me," he said. "They wouldn't even listen. I said, 'I can show you pictures on the internet.'" The Kramers eventually were released without charges. They are seeking monetary and compensatory damages and court costs. Nationwide Insurance declined to comment, citing the litigation. Township Police also declined to comment. Well, clearly, Nationwide is not on your side. Also, let's be realistic here. Let's say, for argument's sake, that it wasn't hibiscus, but an actual marijuana plant. This was growing in their backyard. It's not like we're talking about a thriving drug operation, but rather a few plants. Would that have required pulling guns and handcuffing two senior citizens? And by the way, the temperature was about 80 degrees on that day. Again, is that the way to treat a partially dressed 66-year-old woman with her hands handcuffed behind her back? Oh, please, let the lawsuits begin. Yeah. A traffic camera at an intersection in Bellevue, Washington, recorded a pedestrian who apparently got tired of waiting to cross a busy intersection. Rather than wait for the light to change, he saw a gap in the traffic, got ready by getting into a three-point stance like a football player, then sprinting into traffic and slammed face first into the side of a Tesla SUV going at about 35 miles per hour. The collision left a dent in the vehicle and broke its side mirror. The pedestrian was, of course, knocked down, but got up and ran off. The white male juvenile wearing a hoodie and backpack and carrying a skateboard is wanted on criminal charges. The collision caused significant damage to the vehicle, and the incident was considered a literal hit and run. Police are asking for help to identify the boy. Well, that should be easy enough. Just get a casting of his face that he left in the side of the Tesla. And we have one more story to share with you just before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The Stardust Ranch in Rainbow Valley, Arizona, has a lot to offer potential buyers. Just an hour west of Phoenix, the property boasts a 3,500-square-foot home with a pool, 10 acres, barns, a gated entry, and two portals to another dimension. Yeah. One at the back of the property and one in the fireplace. Owner John Edmonds and his wife bought the property, now listed at $5 million, 20 years ago to run a horse rescue, but he says he's killed more than a dozen extraterrestrials on the property using a samurai sword and has suffered many injuries in his encounters with them. Edmonds told KPNX-TV in October that aliens tried to abduct his wife. They actually levitated her out of the bed in the master chamber and carried her into the parking lot and tried to draw her up into the craft. She won't enter the room anymore. Okay. Listing agent Kimberly Giro notes, this isn't the type of property that you could just place in the MLS and wait for a buyer to come along. I guess not. Okay. So, if you're dealing with killing aliens at your home for the last 20 years, Why in the name of all that is holy have you lived there that long? And I really want to meet the person with $5 million who's willing to dish out that kind of dough for a home where you're going to have to play hide-and-seek with extraterrestrial body snatchers. I mean, seriously. Seriously. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Sometimes the biggest obstacle in the way of your success is you. So, how do you change that? Kevin Corcoran Jr. is the author of Where the Magic Happens, the science and stories behind challenging your comfort zone. Kevin joins us on the line right now from San Diego. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there.
So I guess, Kevin, that you don't get in your own way, or are you sharing stories and ideas because of experiences you had personally?
You know, I was the person who got in my own way the most, and that got to the point where it was frustrating enough for me to start doing something about it.
So how did you realize that part of the problem was indeed you? And once you had that realization, what do you do about it?
So the first time I realized this, I was actually at a pretty young age. It was the first time I ever publicly spoke, and it was supposed to be a play about dinosaurs. And I was given a monologue. And just before the curtains opened, I actually ran off the stage and collapsed onto the ground and started crying, and then I vomited. And that was actually in third grade. And it was, you know, at that time, I didn't know to do anything about it. But later, fast forward, and I played music, and I wanted to be in a live band playing music. And the problem with that is that if you have stage fright, it's not going to go your way at all. When I started playing in a band and we started to play shows, I was actually on stage hiding behind these giant PA speakers, positioning myself where I wouldn't be seen from the audience. And you know, after doing that a number of times, I started to realize that the only person who was going to be able to do anything about this stage fright was me. There was no amount of, you know, reading books or just sitting there that was going to change that for me, unless I read books that actually actively challenged me to do certain things about my stage fright. And, you know, I love the stage fright as a metaphor for all the kinds of fear that hold us back from, you know, doing the things that we really want to do. Because here was this thing I was so passionate about and I really wanted to do it. And this fear, this anxiety of being in front of people held me back consistently over and over.
But I think in this case, though, you're just as you just said, you're talking about something that you were passionate about. Sometimes your passions can overcome whatever fear you might have, or at least balance out the playing field to a certain degree. What about people who need to get over things, but it's not their passion that they're leading towards? In other words, if you have a difficulty getting through your job, which you might not be passionate about, it might be difficult to get past it because you don't have passion working on your side.
Right, yeah, and that's a great question. And I think the most fascinating thing about what I've discovered is that most of our discomfort is the same, regardless of whether it's based on a fear or an anxiety with a passion, or whether it's just that we don't want to do something. Typically, our discomfort in the body physiologically is the same. And so what I've discovered is that if you put yourself through what I call comfort challenges, which are just intentional challenges toward your comfort to make you're purposely trying to be just slightly uncomfortable and then getting used to that feeling. And what's amazing is after doing it enough times in enough different avenues of your life, it starts to transcend into all aspects of your life. So when you're feeling discomfort, whether it's from being on stage or whether it's from not wanting to be in your job or whatever it is, you start to recognize the feelings that are associated with that discomfort. And then you can actually develop the skills and behaviors and thought patterns to overcome that discomfort and find comfort where it's, you know, not very comfortable.
The title of your book is Where the Magic Happens. What do you mean by that title?
So I believe that magic is real. I don't think of it just as, you know, sleight of hand or pulling things out of our sleeves. I think that just being alive is pretty magical. In fact, if you look at the odds of being alive, I believe the last time I looked, it was 1 in 4 billion. So the odds of being alive itself is a miracle. And I think the problem is that a lot of us get caught up in day-to-day routines and deadlines and assignments and all these different things that kind of hold us back from that magical existence that we can have. So when I'm talking about where the magic happens, I'm talking about getting to that point where you're living your life in a way that makes you happy, makes you comfortable, makes you, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive, because through the process of being uncomfortable several times, you actually can become more comfortable in many situations. And, you know, something that just happened for me recently that, is the biggest comfort challenge of my life is that I actually proposed to my girlfriend just about 5 days ago now. Huge comfort challenge. It's making a giant commitment. And it was something that I think anyone would be faced with, all kinds of emotions. And for me, I just looked at it as it was another comfort challenge, another opportunity for me to be courageous. And through that, I have had the most amazing past 5 days, and I look forward to the most amazing life ahead of me. And I wouldn't be there if it wasn't for pushing myself into uncomfortable territory in all of, in this relationship and as well in my past relationships.
Well, first of all, congratulations. First of all, congratulations on your engagement. I happened to have a chance to see your TED Talk, which was excellent, by the way. And it also reminded me of Shonda Rhimes. Shonda Rhimes, who is a powerhouse television producer. She basically owns Thursday nights on ABC. She's the creator of shows like Grey's Anatomy and How to Get Away with Murder and Scandal. And she went through a period of time, as successful as she is, she went through a period of time a couple of years ago where she decided, sort of as a New Year's resolution, that she was going to say yes to everything. And she spent a year doing that, and she says that it was a breakthrough for her. And the thing that I found interesting about it, and again going back to your TED Talk where you talk about saying yes, is here's someone who is already very, very successful. You would think that they'd be at a point where they didn't have these problems, but that's not always the case.
No, it's not. And, I think that's a really good point to touch on, because success is a perception. So she might be incredibly successful in relation to her TV career and her actual, monetary career. But I think that success can also be measured in our level of work-life balance and in our measure of happiness and the amount of time off that we have. So, while she might be incredibly successful externally, there was so obviously something inside of her there was a gap there. And so saying yes, and I don't even think it's just about saying yes. I think it's about doing things differently than what you do all the time. So for her, that was saying yes more often, because I'm guessing she probably said no quite a bit. Now for me, I also did the yes challenge, and I said yes for an entire month. I said yes to everything, but then also for an entire month, I tried to say no to everything as well, because I also typically find myself saying yes passively. So I take on, too many obligations, too many assignments, too many extra jobs. And so my challenge for myself for that extra month was, what if I say no to everything? What if I change that aspect? Let's see what happens with that. And the outcome was stunning. I mean, I had more time off. I felt like I had more value for myself. I was being respectful of my own time. And so, and I haven't read her book, but I'm imagining that she probably gets to a similar outcome, which, it's not about putting ourselves in a position where we just say one word, but it's about putting ourselves in a position where we pause before we say whatever word comes out of our mouth. So, if we're the people that say yes all the time, well, what if we paused and looked for opportunities to say no? And if we say no all the time, to events or to hanging out with new friends or meeting new people or whatever that is, what if we slowed down and instead said yes? So it's about looking for momentary opportunities to change what we are so accustomed to. And in that space, we're able to explore an entire new life that wasn't available to us before because we didn't even realize that we were holding ourselves back by just saying the same words.
Are you someone who chronicles their life? And the reason why I bring that up is because just as you describe this, it sounds like the only way you can be successful at doing what you do is to be aware of the changes you make and the results of those changes by documenting them somehow.
Yeah, so actually my favorite teacher and one of my greatest mentors, he told me that there's a pretty simple formula to learning and to changing, basically changing for the better. So he said that all you really need is to, number one, set intention. So decide whatever it is that you want to do and have an intention through it. Number two, do it. Whatever it is, just go do it and do that thing. And then number three is reflect on it. And I love, there's a quote that's, you know, a lot of people think that we learn by doing, but it's actually that we learn by thinking about the doing that we did. And I love that because, you know, doing new things is amazing, but it's in the time of reflection that we really see how we've changed and how we grow. And, you know, the most fascinating thing to me through this entire journey, through this crazy adventure, is I was seeking personal development. I was seeking growth. I was reading a lot of popular press personal development books. And so these comfort challenges for me began as an external growth. And after going through all of these experiences and writing out all these stories and looking back on everything, I realized that the thing that changed the most for me was actually internally. And I learned that being more mindful and paying more attention to current moments are the most important thing we can do in our lives to find where our magic is going to happen. So it's not just about saying yes to everything. It's about slowing down and looking at why we said yes to the things that we did and then looking for opportunities to change that and seeing what happens. And I love the idea of living life based on a let's see what happens approach. When someone says something like, hey, do you want to go to the beach and jump in the cold water? Well, the response would typically be no. But what if the mindset was, let's see what happens. Let's just see what happens if I try this. And sometimes it might not go as well as planned. Sometimes it might completely suck. But other times you might find a passion or you might find something that you're incredibly interested in that you would have never even known was there.
Well, I'm going to add one more thing to the list of three that you just gave a few moments ago, and that is number four, buy the book, Where the Magic Happens. Kevin,
<Great. laughs>
Kevin, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Absolutely. 100%.
Kevin Cochran, Jr., author of Where the Magic Happens, The Science and Stories Behind Challenging Your Comfort Zone. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0431, and you'll find links to Kevin's site and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As Americans celebrate Thanksgiving this week, children in schools across the nation are learning about how the first pilgrims relied on Native Americans to survive their first year. The members of tribes indigenous to this land taught the new settlers many things, including how to grow food and identify toxic plants. Today, there's still a lot we can learn from Native American tribes. Did you know that there are about 150 tribal courts across the United States? Unlike state and federal courts that use an adversarial system to resolve disputes, many tribal courts use a different approach. Legal experts describe it as a holistic philosophy that focuses not just on punishment and providing victims with payment, but on bringing harmony and peace to the community. Let's be fair. In recent years, U.S. courts have actually adopted some of this philosophy by promoting alternatives to litigation, like mediation and arbitration. This Thanksgiving, learn how alternative dispute resolution often leaves people thankful they ditched their lawsuit and tried something new. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come in the program, we'll give some important tips to those who are caregivers. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, I want to tell you just before we get to our Stuff File news stories here about the book. You know the book I'm talking about, the book that I wrote. The book is called Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. And the book is available for purchase. And just like the title says, it features great conversations with the likes of Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and more, plus two guys who actually left their footprints on the moon. Yeah! Check it out. It's available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as on my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. And you'll find the links to where you can find the book on my website at TheStuffFile.com. And here's a little secret. If you'd like to get an autographed copy of the book, send me an email to Peter@TheStuffFile.com, and I'll tell you how you can do that. Okay? There you go. Check it out. And what are you waiting for? By the way, it makes a great holiday gift for those in your family or loved ones who are TV and film buffs. I'm just saying, putting that idea in your head. Anyway, let's get back to the stuff. A man in an Atlanta, Georgia Target store removed a cell phone from a box and slipped the phone into his pocket. A manager confronted him, but decided to back off when the man pulled an axe out of his backpack. That turned shoplifting into armed robbery, and the man escaped into the woods near the store. The manager gave a good description of the culprit, and police quickly spotted a suspect who ran when he saw the officers. They were pretty sure they had the right guy, even though he had changed his shirt. But he didn't change his backpack, said Officer Lisa Bender, so I think that's what got him. That was at least in part because Funzale Woods was wearing a Pokemon backpack, Bender said, which are normally a bright color and typically easy to spot. Yeah, because, you know, a crazed dude running through the woods carrying an axe just isn't unusual enough to attract police attention. By the way, what grown man wears a Pokemon backpack anyway? Oh yeah, an axe-wielding freak, that's who. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Victoria Ugalde was supposed to be on the way to jail for failure to show up in court after getting a traffic ticket. But the jail van had no room, so she sat in the holding cell at a Denver, Colorado police station, chained to a bench for almost 13 hours. They forgot about me, she said. I was looking in the camera. Can anybody help me? Apparently not. She had to use the floor for a toilet and for a bed. There was an officer at the desk, and he was supposed to be checking in on her every half hour, but admitted that he was busy reading a book. The book's title, Emotional Intelligence 2.0. He was suspended for 7 days, but that was later reduced to 3, and Victoria is considering filing a lawsuit. Okay, let me see if I got this straight. Failure to pay a ticket, jail time. Failure to take care of a chained prisoner, a few days off work. Does that seem about right to you? Forget emotional intelligence. How about any intelligence? Yikes. Anyway, let's get to our final guest on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? According to Dr. Camille Superson, 40% of millennials are now caregivers, 45% are men, and about 1.4 million children in the U.S. between the ages of 8 and 18 are now in this role too. Dr. Superson says these unsung heroes need help. A former caregiver herself for over a decade to two bedbound parents, she is the author of Essential Resource Guide for Caregivers, Save Time, Save Money, Save Your Sanity. She joins us on the line right now from Arizona. Hi, Dr. Superson.
Good morning.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, those numbers that I mentioned, the amount of caregivers, the amount of millennial caregivers, the amount of men, the amount of children in the U.S., I would assume to a certain degree that a lot of those numbers would also per capita be exactly the same here in Canada. It's a problem that is happening all over the place. I am at the tail end of the baby boomers, and of course we were the largest population base, and that large population base is now getting older and to a certain degree will need to be taken care of in some respects to a larger number than the generation before. Would you agree?
Totally agree.
So the millennials are really caught in this situation. I know, as I said in the introduction, that you took care of your own parents. Was this for you the impetus to write your book?
Absolutely. What ended up happening is after they passed away, I had accumulated a handful of additional resources that I did not have from government agencies or any other agencies that should have provided the information. And most of the information was free that I received. And that was part of the reason why I felt an urgency to write the book, because people don't know many of these hidden, unknown, untapped resources.
Now, I would assume that because of your profession, things were maybe a little bit easier, and again, we're talking relatively speaking here, easier for you because of your medical background, and I would assume it must have been, for lack of a better term, a horrendous situation to be put in that situation for a decade.
It's true, and when it initially happened, it was quite sudden because my mother had a stroke, so it was nothing that I prepared for. And even with my medical background, it didn't mean anything when it came to becoming a caregiver. So I found later on that all of us are basically starting from ground zero, trying to do the best we can to help those we love.
As far as your book is concerned, whom exactly did you write it for? And the reason why I ask that is, did you write it for people who are currently going through the caregiver role, or people who might want to prepare themselves if they think they might be in this role in the future?
All of the above, plus people like you and me, because there's a good portion of the resources that are in the book that are for everyone, that people don't know where they can save money and time on things that they use every single day.
Well, give us a couple of examples of savings that you're talking about. Because again, the subtitle of your book is Save Time, Save Money, Save Your Sanity. So I want to tackle on some of those things. Let's talk about saving time first.
All right. The amount of time that most people, caregivers in this particular situation that I'm going to quote, the average caregiver spends anywhere between 11 and 13 hours a month looking for information. That doesn't mean they find it. That means that they're looking for information. And that breaks down to almost 4 40-hour work weeks a year. And that's pretty astounding. I can attest to that, having gone through that.
And so what about saving money, the other part of your subtitle?
Most of the resources that are in the book will save thousands of dollars every single year. And most importantly, many of the resources in the book are free. And that was the astounding part that I discovered through the 10 years of caregiving. And many of those free resources were not provided by agencies, like I mentioned. They were provided by total strangers. They were provided by friends or family members that worked diligently trying to uncover them. So knowing that I was not alone in this situation, that there were other people just like me going through this every single day, costing them their lives often, because one-third of all caregivers die before the people that they're taking care of, which is an unbelievable statistic I didn't know.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that astounding?
That is very astounding. The third part of the subtitle is Save Your Sanity. I'm kind of reminded of the instructions one gets when they step on board an aircraft that the stewardess shares, and that is, should the oxygen mask deploy, put it on yourself first before you take care of others. Would that be a good analogy for what you're trying to tell people here?
Absolutely, because it's also something I did not do. And so talking to many family caregivers, they're doing the exact same thing. They're becoming human sacrifices, a lot of times because they don't know and they want to do everything possible for their loved ones. So often risking their own lives through ill health, not making appointments, the stress associated with lack of funds because they deplete so readily and so quickly. People, unless they go through it, they don't really realize how financially taxing caregiving can be. And here's a statistic that I found out, too, that is pretty astounding. Approximately 40% of all working caregivers will go through all or most of their life savings. And wow. Then when they're in that position down the road, there's no money for themselves either. Plus, it puts the financial burden on their own personal family.
Hmm. You, as I mentioned, are someone who's in the medical profession. You've now written this book, Hindsight is Always 20/20. What, in your estimation, was the biggest mistake you made during your time as a caregiver?
Not taking care of myself, perhaps, the biggest thing, because there would be days that I wouldn't even eat properly. I mean, I would get through with, you know, a quick breakfast and some coffee or something of that nature. But I find that myself, as well as so many others, neglect themselves on basic essentials, you know, like eating, sleeping. And sleeping is a big thing because of the stress for many of the caregivers out there and people at large. So,
well, let's. I want to ask about the people at large for a second, because I was just about to ask, if someone knows someone else who is a caregiver, knowing what you're sharing right now, what should they do if they want to help their loved ones, their friends, who are in a caregiver situation?
First of all, I totally believe that this book will be absolutely helpful to them, because it'll address a lot of those issues. And also on the website, which my website is stressfreecaregiver.com, when a person purchases one or more copies of the book, they will also get a free gift there, which is a quick start guide for caregivers, which will address so many issues that they may not even consider. And I try to address all those different issues to pay attention to that they do need to address. And one of the most important areas that they often neglect and they struggle at the end is finding all the contacts, the legal information, the insurance policies, the ownership policies of a house or veterans papers or divorces or birth certificates or all those things. They're often scattered and not in one place. So it would be a great idea for them to start getting those in order before they ever even proceed, and even if they don't need it immediately.
Vital information indeed. The book is entitled Essential Resource Guide for Caregivers. Save time, save money, save your sanity. You mentioned the website. It's stressfreecaregiver.com, correct?
Yes, yes. And if anybody, one of the important aspects that all caregivers face, not just the millennials, is finding respite for their loved one or for themselves so they can get away. And also on the website, they're able to download free of charge, no obligation, a respite guide that will give all the free respite resources available in their area.
Excellent. Dr. Camille Superson, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Camille Superson, author of Essential Resource Guide for Caregivers. Save time, save money, save your sanity. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0431, and you'll find links to Camille's site and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A Chicago woman sporting a flimsy disguise was arrested for stealing $126,000 from the bank where she used to work. She was recognized by her former colleagues. 24-year-old Latasha Gamble was charged with robbing the Chase Bank at gunpoint. One of the tellers working at the time told authorities something felt off about the robber when she took a seat in the waiting lobby. After briefly fidgeting with dog biscuits, Gamble allegedly approached another teller to show them some documents, only to pull out a handgun. "Let's go to the vault," she said, according to the complaint. When told entering the vault would require a dual access code, the robber grabbed the bank employee by the hair and forced them to enter the code. She said she would shoot them if they looked at her, likely because she used to work with them. After Gamble fled the Lakeview Chase with nearly $126,000, bank tellers told investigators they were fairly certain they used to work with the robber. They were eventually able to quickly identify Gamble despite her disguise, which was a dark curly wig, black lipstick, black winter gloves, a tan winter coat, and a patterned pink nightgown. Chase was able to confirm that she was still an employee with the bank, but at another branch. Police arrested Gamble when she showed up for work at the end of the week at a different Chase bank in Chicago. She initially denied the robbery, claiming that she was with a relative and then the dentist when it occurred. She eventually admitted she'd asked the relative to cover for her should they be approached by police and confessed to the robbery. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you think that wearing a nightgown, dark wig, and black lipstick would make a good disguise to rob a bank that you used to work at? And why would you think that after stealing $126,000 from your former bank branch, that going back to work at another bank branch for the same bank would be a good idea? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0431. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0431. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes. Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.